From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. British Prime Minister Theresa May said today that the United Kingdom must do more to fight Islamist extremism in the wake of the third terrorist attack in the UK in as many months.
Working with other democratic governments, we will agree ways to regulate cyberspace and prevent the spread of extremism and terrorist planning online. We will continue to support military action to destroy ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And we will do more to deny this ideology the physical space to breed here at home.
At least seven people were killed and dozens injured, many critically on Saturday night, when a van intentionally rammed into people on London Bridge, and then three attackers got out and began stabbing people with large knives. Jim Walsh is Here Now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program, and he's with us in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good to be with you.
Well, May says the UK has to do more to fight extremism both online and on the ground. What more could the UK be doing?
Well, I think we have to put first things first, and we are in early days here. It seems to me a little early to be offering policy prescriptions when we really don't know what happened. They haven't released the names of the people. We don't know about their backgrounds. Are they immigrants? Are they British citizens? Were they radicalized in prison or on the internet? The answers to those questions, in other words, facts, should determine us figuring out what went right, what went wrong, and what we can do better. But we shouldn't jump to policy before we actually know what the heck happened.
But we can look back at previous attacks, and we can say that there were some people who are, homegrown terrorists, as they say, brought up in that country, and they somehow self-radicalize or, with the help of others, become radicalized.
Well, it's certainly true that there are different paths to radicalization, and you'd want to have sort of a policy prescription for each of these after figuring out which was the most important. The internet is one, and she brought up proposals at the G7 about the internet. Awfully tough to police the internet, which is really an international institution free of government. I mean, individual governments, China's, the Iran's of the world, North Korea's regulate the internet, but it's a tough nut to crack, and that's a long-term prospect. There, again, is radicalization in prisons. There are people who travel overseas and get exposed to terrorist ideology there. So each of these is different. Each requires a different mechanism to address it.
What about when you get to the point where you already have a terrorist who has been radicalized and is ready to carry out an attack? Is there anything you can do at that point? I mean, you can't put barriers in front of every bridge and sidewalk in a city.
Absolutely. And I know this is going to be tough for people to accept, but in some ways you could say, this was an attack on a soft target. It wasn't an attack on, the British Parliament. It didn't kill thousands of people because it involved semi-automatic guns and explosives. It was a knife attack and a car attack in a public place. That's pretty hard to stop. What you can, that's the point at which you're relying on intelligence, counterterrorism and intelligence, trying to diagnose in advance, get information in advance based on people's travel patterns or on tips you get from the community that would give you early warning that something is happening.
I want to listen to something that former Secretary of State John Kerry said on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
The fact is that if people want to kill themselves, this is really hard for law enforcement. I mean, I know from my own law enforcement days how hard people work and how significant the intelligence gathering and coordination component of this is. But if someone is ready to just go out and meet a fusillade of law enforcement bullets and die, you can take people with you.
So given that he is saying that, how do you square that with what Theresa May says, which is we can't just accept that these things could happen?
Well, I would say that John Kerry is right. There's no such thing as 100% security. I mean, these things, if people are determined to kill themselves, they will. But I'm sympathetic to Prime Minister May, and after all, she is in an election campaign this week, and saying, you've got to continue to work the problem. You've got to do more. But you shouldn't do more if doing more makes things worse rather than better. And some of the comments she has made would suggest policies that might actually make the fight against terrorism more difficult.
One more thing I have to ask you about, Jim, while we have you. Five Arab countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Yemen, and Bahrain, have severed diplomatic ties with Qatar today. This seems like it came out of nowhere. What happened?
Well, the history of the Gulfies, of the Gulf states, is there tends to be bickering. And as recently as 2014, the states in the region broke diplomatic relations with Qatar. This is a little more severe. It's sort of almost a blockade, you know, no travel, no goods. So I think it is more severe. It's basically, you know, there's a list of countries there, but it's basically two countries that are doing this. It's Saudi Arabia and its supporters, the countries that are in Saudi Arabia's pockets, and it is Egypt. It's complicating for the U.S. because the U.S. has a military base there. And so how can we coordinate an anti-ISIS campaign if one of the players is sort of walled off? So I expect this will blow over in time, but it'll be an irritant in the near term.
That's Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst who's with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump ultimately expressed sympathy for the victims of the London attack, but he began his tweet Saturday night by saying the attack justified his call for a travel ban. Then he completely mischaracterized the words of the London mayor, saying the mayor said there was no reason for alarm. The mayor's office responded that he'd actually said there was no reason for alarm about increased police presence, to which President Trump tweeted today, "Pathetic excuse by London Mayor Sadiq Khan, who had to think fast on his no reason to be alarmed statement." And it's just Monday. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving joins us. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Robin.
Let's listen to what Mayor Sadiq Khan, who is Muslim, actually said.
Londoners will see an increased police presence today and over the course of the next few days. No reason to be alarmed. One of the things the police and all of us need to do is make sure we're as safe as we possibly can be.
So, Ron, President Trump in tweeting at least seven dead and London mayor says no reason to be alarmed without context. You know, either the president didn't know, which raises questions, or deliberately mischaracterized what the mayor said. That raises questions, too. What are yours?
The first question is, where did he get this impression? And it appears to coincide perhaps with something characterized on the Drudge Report during the first hours of reaction. It certainly did not seem to have come from any kind of looking into the actual circumstances or having had the opportunity to actually hear the mayor. And the people on his staff, that is the president's staff, are indicating that they're just really unaware of where he got this impression.
Well, so, and this is the person who has perhaps the best intelligence and information in the world, but he's apparently getting it elsewhere. Look, Donald Trump Jr. also mischaracterized the London mayor a while back after another attack. He said that the mayor said terror was just part of living in a big city. The London mayor actually said that's why we have to be vigilant. Why would the Trumps do this? It would be easy to conclude that it's because the mayor is Muslim.
This is a discordant note, you know, in what has really been a moment of shared outrage and sorrow between the UK and the US. It seems highly unnecessary to do it unless you are thinking of all of this as an opportunity to make some kind of a point, an argument for the president's own approach to terrorism. And that does seem to have been paramount in his mind over the weekend and again today.
Well, as we said, the president took to Twitter to promote what he said was his travel ban on Muslims from several countries. This is this morning. But his lawyers have asked the Supreme Court to take up lower court decisions against the ban, and their defense is it is not a travel ban. So has Trump just sealed his fate with the Supreme Court?
This is a curious moment, not only with respect to the Supreme Court, but also the criticisms that he has been tweeting out today of his own Justice Department. They should have done this. They should have done that, as though they did not work for him. Mm-hmm. And it isn't also, of course, a charm offensive with regard to the federal courts in general to call them slow and political. They have a lot of power over what's going to happen and what's going to happen to the Trump agenda. And it almost seems as though the president were trying at some times to alienate the courts, including the Supreme Court, as if to goad them into striking down some of his executive orders, as though someone were trying to create a fall guy for whatever terrorism might happen in this country in the future.
Well, speaking of which. On Thursday, the fired FBI Director James Comey is scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. It was thought for a while that perhaps President Trump would use his executive powers to stop that testimony. Seems to be going forward. Comey's going to be asked, did President Trump tell you to stop the Russia investigation? Do you think there will be nuance in his answer, or will we get a yes or a no?
There is every possibility that Former Director Comey will choose a more nuanced response than a simple yes or no. I don't think that he wants to detonate a maximum explosion in the middle of these hearings. But it is to some degree a yes or no question that it would take a certain amount of strain to hear the yes or the no, but it should probably wind up being audible or else the senator is going to ask again.
Well, and can they ask to see the memo, the notes that Comey is said to have, in which he says that the president asked him to please lay off on the investigation? Will he have to produce those?
We expect the committee to want to see those documents and any other documents that might be relevant to their line of inquiry.
Yeah, just in the few seconds we have, how big is this testimony for President Trump?
It could be critical. If it seems to exonerate the president, it could take a lot of the air out of this whole Russia connection investigation. But if it does not, it takes that investigation to a new level of seriousness and threat to the president himself.
Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. That testimony lies ahead this week. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
How did Syria spiral down to the failed nation it now is? Well, you'd be forgiven for forgetting. It's been dizzying. But a new terrific documentary from Sebastian Younger lays it all out. We meet one of the young men who, during the Arab Spring, wrote anti-government graffiti on a school wall and was tortured by President Assad's men for doing so. We see the peaceful protests in 2011 that followed. And when Assad begins firing on those protesters, his own people, we meet mothers who went to protest to keep an eye on their kids and then watch them die.
If God gave me 1,000 years to live, I will never forget that sound.
And that's just the beginning. The protests turn into civil war. Anti-Assad militias multiply. The U.S. disappoints them. Turkey, the Kurds, Russia, ISIS all get in the ring. The fighting, Assad's barrel bombs, airstrikes, produce the largest refugee crisis since World War II. Longtime war correspondent Sebastian Younger's new film is Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It airs Sunday on the National Geographic Channel. And Sebastian, I feel like we're seeing footage we have never seen before. We are placed right in the story. Where'd you get it?
So what we did basically was establish connections with people, Syrians, who were able to shoot for us. We even tried to get someone to shoot for us with ISIS. Ultimately, that didn't work. But ISIS put so much footage online that they shoot themselves that we were actually able to take some of that.
Now, it's chilling, and you're right there. Let's start at the beginning, March of 2011. As we said, the Assad regime cracking down after some kids scrawl some graffiti. You speak to one of the kids. This was during the Arab Spring. Other authoritarian leaders were falling. Here's former NPR correspondent Sarah Chase, now of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in your film, talking about the turmoil in other Arab countries during the Arab Spring.
Bashar al-Assad looks at that and says, I'll be damned. So he was willing to respond to peaceful demonstrations with maximal use of force.
And there again we see Assad's men shooting on civilians. What would you say about, first of all, Bashar al-Assad having put this together?
Well, where to begin? I mean, he's a brutal dictator who mercilessly ordered his security forces to open fire with automatic weapons on his own citizens simply for asking for and eventually demanding democratic reforms and human dignity and human rights. Eventually, he escalated to dropping bombs on people, on civilian neighborhoods. And finally, he wound up using nerve gas, chemical weapons against civilians. He's an absolute monster.
Well, people are rounded up and sent to prisons and radicalized there if they didn't starve to death in those prisons. Militias are forming and multiplying, and people are trying to flee. We meet two brothers who we see throughout the movie, Radwan and Marwan. They fled their home in Aleppo with their families, children, hiding out, constant barrel bombing. Let's listen.
They were in Aleppo. They fled. They wound up in Manbij, which was under the control of ISIS. We got a camera into that family, and they volunteered to self-document their lives under ISIS. And then their conversation, their decision to try to flee ISIS, hidden in the back of a truck. Mm. they did it. They made it out alive. They got to Turkey and then eventually onto a rubber raft trying to get to Greece.
Which we should say, they don't make it. They're turned back.
They're turned back, yeah. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about in this film was this conundrum of war refugees for the West, for the modern world. Like, what do you do with people who are sensibly fleeing an incredibly dangerous situation with their children? Does the world owe people like that a refuge? I don't say this overtly, but it's pretty clear if you watch the film, it's the only compassionate conclusion you can really come to.
Well, one of the things that you take away from the film, because the refugee situation is at the very end. We're watching year after year, 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, as this grows and festers, and it's like a petri dish that produces incredible ugliness, including ISIS. You know, much of this we know, but I don't know how many people know, as you say in the film, you feel that Assad made an agreement with ISIS. I mean, the narrative has always been that ISIS was also fighting the Assad regime and then also fighting the local militias. You say, you know, Assad pretty much made an agreement with ISIS.
Assad understood that if the rebels that he was fighting were reasonable people who just wanted democratic reforms, that the West would be inclined to support them, even to get arms to them. But if he could make those people look like Islamic radicals, of course, the West wouldn't touch them. So he released from his own prisons the most radical Islamists so that they could form radical groups in the countryside that he could then fight. That effectively prevented the West from funneling support into them. Eventually, ISIS grew out of that. The last thing he wants is for ISIS to be defeated because, of course, ISIS is such a monstrous organization. It's what's keeping the West from actually intervening and involving itself in an otherwise legitimate demand for equality and dignity by the Syrian people.
Talk more about the U.S. and the role. We see President Obama make his comment about the red line in the sand. We see all of the militias on the footage that you've curated waiting for the response from the Obama administration after Assad indeed uses chemical weapons on his own people. It doesn't come. Instead, we see the footage of the president walking out in that, you know, very famous now moment where he walks to the podium and says, in fact, I will not be responding to what's happening. Is this the U.S.'s fault?
No, we didn't cause the Syrian civil war. It was part of the Arab Spring. The Syrian government lost control of the situation on the ground, and 400,000 people have been killed. With the nerve gas, we finished this film before Donald Trump rocketed the airbase that actually delivered nerve gas to a civilian neighborhood a month or so ago. Obama declined to do that. And on the one hand, it's outrageous. I mean, on the one hand, using nerve gas against civilians absolutely should trigger an international response. On the other hand, you can kind of see where Obama's coming from. He's been handed two wars by the former president. He's sort of extricating himself from Iraq. These wars were very, very unpopular. And now he's asked to wade into another Middle Eastern war. You can kind of understand his reluctance.
Talk about some of the other things that you learned. When you lay it out like this, you really get to see so many connective tissues. So, for instance, you see the militias, these brave Syrian militias, kicking ISIS out of Syria. But ISIS goes to Iraq, where it raids all the army outposts, steals the weapons, and goes back into Syria. Well, you know, what are some of the other moments that became clear to you when you lay it out?
Eventually, if you let these situations go on for too long, Somalia, Nigeria, Afghanistan, Syria, you get radicalism. ISIS rose up because that kind of anarchy and chaos is a very rich ground for radical thinking. But they came out of northern Iraq. So we have to understand that when the U.S. went into Iraq, they basically supported a Shia government that had the backing of Iran and sidelined the Sunnis in Iraq. Eventually, al-Qaeda and then ISIS came in and promised to protect the Sunni population from the Shia government in Baghdad. And that was the rise of really violent radicalism in that part of the world. And it eventually became known as ISIS.
Again, you've curated so much video, including ISIS propaganda, the beautiful, really Hollywood-inspired, as you say, videos that they make, the Nasheeds. We're going to listen to a little, but what is that?
The Nasheeds are religious songs that basically call people to jihad, to violence, to war. They're songs that advocate attacks on the West and the joining of ISIS in Syria.
They sound like pop tunes, and we understand that ISIS is against music.
ISIS is against music unless it furthers the aims of a radical religious ideology and bolsters their regime. I mean, almost any government in the world is guilty of condoning things that help them, even though they're against them.
Well, interestingly, you have scholars throughout the film, and one reminds us that, you know, there was music used during the French Revolution. And when you listen closely to the lyrics now, we'll soak the fields with blood. I mean, we have had songs like this historically.
Yes, one of the things I wanted to do was point out that the public use of violence by ISIS, the public cutting off of heads and the public torture of people, is an attempt to intimidate people in Syria and in the world. It's no different from the public lynchings of black men in the South well into the 20th century. Those murders could have been committed in private, in secret. They weren't. They were done in public in the town square for exactly the same reason that ISIS was conducting violence in the town square.
Mm. Sebastian Younger, the film is Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. It'll be on the National Geographic Channel on Sunday. And Sebastian, I know that tomorrow you are going to be showing this to Congress?
Yes, we're taking our film to Washington, D.C., and if Congress comes, it's up to them. But we're making it available to them, and I'm very much hoping that they see it. There's an enormous question in my mind about war refugees and what this country and other countries owe the kinds of people who are depicted in this film. Really good people, unfortunate people who have been driven out of their country by war.
Sebastian, thanks.
Thank you.
Today, President Trump announced a proposal to privatize air traffic control. The plan would separate air traffic control functions from the Federal Aviation Administration, which President Trump says would reduce inefficiencies.
For too many years, our country has tolerated unacceptable delays at the airport, long wait times on the tarmac, and a slowing of commerce and travel that costs us billions and billions of dollars in lost hours and lost dollars themselves.
Joining us now is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Jill, let's start with how this would be paid for. The president said it wouldn't need taxpayer money. How would the funding work?
Yeah, I mean, this, I guess, is going to be going through Congress, and it would actually really try to get this money through other means and through the budgeting process. You know, the funny thing is, this is part of the FAA's broader $35.8 billion modernization effort. It's known as NextGen. And it was already sort of in the works, right? But it was really meant to take place over a shorter period of time. National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, he said that this system will allow for more direct routes. It would cut down in flight times and fuel usage. I don't know about that. I think that when you have every other modern aviation system running more efficiently, and with one that we have relies still on land-based radar, we really need to be switching to a GPS system.
But do you have to go private in order to do that?
Yeah, I don't think we have to go private. I mean, the issue of going private, I guess, is an interesting one because, you know, the controllers themselves have said that the process has gotten bogged down because of the threat of government shutdowns. Or, you know, we've seen there are times where we've had government not even shutting down, but like we've shut down the budgeting process. And so there's been slow implementation of this modernization process. And it's a weird thing because you're like, hey, wait, the unions are actually saying they're on board with this. They say this protects them from the threat of a government shutdown once we privatize it, and it might actually get the job done faster.
Well, tension surrounding the air traffic control workforce is not new. Back in 1981, President Reagan famously fired 11,000 air traffic controllers who went on strike. Here's a bit of his speech from then.
We cannot compare labor-management relations in the private sector with government. Government cannot close down the assembly line. It has to provide without interruption the protective services which are government's reason for being.
So a lot of history here, Jill, but what are the people who think that it's a bad idea to privatize air traffic control saying?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, there are some trade groups, because we talked about some of the air traffic controller unions being in favor of this. Some of the trade groups like the National Business Aviation Association, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, they said that private air traffic management would give the larger airlines even more control and, frankly, threaten the private aviation market in smaller communities. There's also been some questions about whether this privatization would pose a national security risk. This, of course, being very important today in the light of what's just been happening,
right,
but especially during the transition period. Some say there could be some legal difficulties of transferring the FAA's assets into a nonprofit corporation. And of course, who would oversee it? We don't know the details yet.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Jill, thank you.
Thanks.
Wonder Woman opened with a punch this weekend. The film took in over $100 million at the box office, the biggest opening ever for a female director, Patty Jenkins, one of the best-reviewed superhero films of all time. Wonder Woman, the comic character, was given her superpowers by the Greek gods, but she was drawn by artist Harry G. Peter and created by psychologist William Moulton Marston,
who said that he created her as psychological propaganda for the new type of woman I believe should rule the world.
That's the applause line there.
And then it gets weird.
That's historian Jill Lepore, who wrote the 2015 book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman.
Could I have your attention?
We sat down last week at the elegant Massachusetts Historical Society dinner gala at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston to talk about a range of things. But I wanted you to hear the story of Wonder Woman because it's also the story of a wondrous historian who also has superpowers of investigation. Our cast of characters, Dr. William Moulton Marston, he created the female superhero Wonder Woman. But Marston secretly had both a wife, Elizabeth Holloway, and a mistress, Olive Byrne, all living together. To each his own, but what's really interesting, Olive Byrne, the mistress, was also the niece of Margaret Sanger, the revered feminist and birth control pioneer, who was close to the family. And, well, let's let Jill Lepore give you the headline.
Wonder Woman is Margaret Sanger. This just was a family secret that was greatly hidden. So it was a few years back. I completely fell into the story, and I just could not claw my way out. It was like at the beginning, at the bottom of a well. I had an assignment from The New Yorker. This was in 2011, during the Republican primary season, where all the GOP candidates were asked to sign a pro-life pledge that if they were elected, they would defund Planned Parenthood. And I was asked to write a piece about the history of Planned Parenthood, and I did reporting things that you would do. I went to the birth control clinic in Brooklyn, which is the site of the first birth control clinic in the United States. I went to some rallies, and, you know, I did just kind of beat reporting things. What I bring to The New Yorker is that I'm a historian, and I am just what historians call an archive rat. Like, I just love being in an archive. So I went to Smith, which has Margaret Sanger's papers. Margaret Sanger was the founder of Planned Parenthood. She found it in 1916, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of boxes. And I'm paging through these things. But meanwhile, at the same time I was working on this journalistic piece for The New Yorker about Planned Parenthood, I had agreed to write a scholarly paper for the Yale Law School on the history of evidence. And I wanted to write about the origins of the lie detector. So it turns out the guy who invented the lie detector invented it at Harvard. And his name was William Moulton Marston. And at the time, William Moulton Marston's Wikipedia entry was like, William Moulton Marston invented the lie detector in 1913 when he was a Harvard sophomore. And in 1941, he created Wonder Woman. Meanwhile, he was married to two women, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, who was his wife, and Olive Byrne, who was their mistress, and they raised four children together. Period. And they're like under references and external links, like blank.
How had nobody noticed this before?
But you couldn't find anything more about him. And a lot of people had knocked at the door of the family, the literary executor of the state, who is a retired obstetrician in Florida, and who has the names of each of his three parents. His name is Byrne Holloway Marston, after his mother, and his father. And I wrote to him, but when I was at Smith in the Planned Parenthood papers, I kept finding letters from people in Marston's family to Margaret Sanger and about Planned Parenthood, because when Margaret Sanger opened the first birth control clinic in New York in 1916, she did so with her sister, who was also a nurse, who was Ethel Byrne, who was Olive Byrne's mother. And Olive
the mistress,
Byrne, the mistress of the guy who created Wonder Woman. And Olive Byrne, when she grew up, became Margaret Sanger's personal secretary and also handled her estate and sorted through her papers. So I got completely obsessed with this weird coincidence of families, and I went in to see the curator at the archives. And I was trying to be sneaky because I had found something out really great, but I didn't really want her to know. But Smith also had the papers of Gloria Steinem and Ms. Magazine. And Gloria Steinem, when Ms. Magazine started in 1972, on the cover of the first issue was Wonder Woman. But the Steinem papers and the Ms. Magazine papers were not yet cataloged. So they were just in the boxes in which they came, which were like Gloria Steinem's shoe boxes. So I went in to see the curator, because curators always know the collections when they're cataloging. And I sat down with this woman named Maida, and I had a little piece of paper. And I said, as you know, I'm here writing a piece on Planned Parenthood. Yes, yes, yes. But I thought I'd look at the Steinem and Ms. Magazine papers, but I'm looking only for correspondence with particular individuals. So if I give you the names of the people, can you just tell me what boxes to look in? Because there's no finding guide. And I said, well, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, she's box 42, folder 7. Okay, Olive Byrne, box 205, folder 1. Wonder Woman, and she looks at me, and she looks at her notes, and mine. She looks at my piece of paper, and she leaps out of her chair, and she well nigh screams, "Oh my God! Wonder Woman is Margaret Sanger!" Whereupon I leap out of my chair and say, "Shh!" I was so upset. But like the only other person on the planet who would connect these things was the person who had cataloged the papers of Margaret Sanger and of Gloria Steinem.
And she hadn't yet connected it.
And she hadn't made the connection through these fairly obscure people from the Marston family.
Well, I mean, it is just so remarkable. One of the connections that is made, I just want to mention this one. Sanger likes to show women breaking out of chains. That's part of the message, you're going to break out of the chain of not having control of your own bodies. But Marston, he likes to show Wonder Woman in submission. She's like chained a lot, and to the point where the editors were kind of like, that's getting a little funny what you're doing. And he would say, oh, no, it's like, Margaret Sanger said they're breaking out of chains, but it kind of wasn't.
Yeah, it kind of wasn't. And I think we could very easily move outside the bounds of propriety in discussing the private life of William Moulton Marston. But what happened was, Marston said, I have created a woman who is an allegory for the emancipation of women. And this is in 1941. In every episode, she breaks out of her chains, which means that she has to be chained up in every episode, or roped, or hogtied, or bound and gagged. And so this is the forerunner of DC Comics. They start getting letters from soldiers at the front saying, can you have a little bit more of the chains, because I'm enjoying the red boots too. Can they be in more of the frames with the chains? And also the red bustier could be, meanwhile, the Catholic Church bans Wonder Woman for indecent exposure. But Marston keeps insisting to his editor at DC Comics, she's an allegory for the emancipation of women.
Like the two I have at home.
Like the two I have at home. So, it's, exactly. One of whom raises the children and the other of whom earns all the money. Like, he has two wives to do everything. He doesn't really do very much. But, like, the thing is, as a historian, I feel pretty strongly that unless you have direct evidence, you really shouldn't be inferring anything about people's private lives. That said, I did have to sit down on a couch with Byrne Holloway Marston, this delightful, wonderful, genteel, retired obstetrician in Florida. Lovely man, incredibly generous, who did let me see the family papers, with incredible material that no one had ever seen before. Incredible, like, just so much fun. And I had to say to him, I'm wondering about the bondage in Wonder Woman, because people often think that it's a little autobiographical on the part of your father. And he says to me, do you mean, did the ladies tie him up? And I said, I'm afraid that I have, like, due diligence. I have to just ask you this question. And he said, not that I ever saw. But to Marston's argument, the iconography of the suffrage movement involved chains, because the suffragists had previously been abolitionists, and the iconography of abolitionism was the chained man breaking free of his chains. And when suffragists began fighting for the right to vote, they used that same iconography. Suffragists marched through the streets in chains. When suffrage cartoonists wrote about women's emancipation, they showed Amazonian women breaking free of their chains. Marston was just actually calling on the iconography that he'd grown up with. He'd grown up with suffragists. He'd seen this stuff. He had been a teenager in the 19-teens.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, no.
Historian and New Yorker writer Jill Lepore at the Massachusetts Historical Society Gala at the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston last week. Her 2014 book is The Secret History of Wonder Woman. And by the way, on the New Yorker website, Jill says she found the new movie smart and charming, but it renders invisible, erases the fights women waged a century ago for representation, contraception, and equality.
A pioneer of research into the dangers of trans fats has died. Fred Kummerow was 102 years old. The University of Illinois professor emeritus was one of the first scientists to discover a link between trans fats and heart disease back in the 1950s. He then spent almost six decades campaigning for their removal from food products. Trans fats were used in a wide variety of foods, including microwave popcorn, frozen pizza, cookies, and margarine. Finally, in June 2015, the FDA ordered that they be phased out. Kummerow said of that move that science won out. I spoke with Fred Kummerow in May of 2014, and I asked him how difficult it was to get the word out about the dangers of trans fats.
Very difficult, because it wasn't obvious. This trans fat was put in a diet in 1910, and when these fats were eaten by people, they didn't develop any prostacyclin. Now, prostacyclin is a component in the blood that prevents the clotting of blood. So if you don't have any prostacyclin, you can't clot your blood. Huh. And a lot of those people died of sudden death. That's one reason for asking the FDA to ban trans fat.
Now, the prevailing view about heart disease is that cholesterol is a major factor in heart disease. You don't buy that, do you?
It's perfectly normal to think that, because when you feed cholesterol to a rabbit, it gets atherosclerosis. That is, the arteries look just like the arteries, almost like the arteries, of people who had heart disease. And I had found in a study I did with 12 MD PhDs from Japan, and we did a complete analysis of what happens in the arteries of the pigs. And we started off from even before they're born. And by the time they were 3 years old, they had exactly the same kind of structure in their coronary arteries as the people who had died of heart disease. So I knew that cholesterol was in a diet was not necessary to produce the same kind of change in the coronary arteries of pigs that are present also in the coronary arteries of people.
And we should say that you've put this to the test yourself. You have an egg, something known to have cholesterol in it, every day for breakfast.
That's correct. The egg contains all of the amino acids that you need. Now, amino acids are present in different foods, but they're all of them are present in animal fat. That is, like cheese, beef, pork, eggs, chicken, and fish. So if you eat those kind of foods, you'll have all the amino acids that you need to build what is called endothelium cells. And they carry all the functions in the body that cause life.
Professor, before I let you go, I want to ask you one thing that many people may be wondering, and that I'd like to ask anybody who is able to make it all the way to age 100, which is, what is your secret to longevity?
Eating correctly. That is, eating enough amino acids, that is, the eight amino acids, so your liver can make the LDL and HDL that your body needs. And they should also eat vegetables and fruit.
So what did you have for lunch today?
I had a bit of a steak that I had left over from Sunday, lettuce, tomato, avocado, and squash. That's cooked up. Squash is a good source of fibers, which you need to carry your food through your intestinal tract. And I had a glass of milk. I always have a glass of milk at breakfast, at noon, and at night. And I also exercise every day. And I keep my mind busy. I think it's very important for somebody who retires to do something that keeps his mind occupied and not just sit there and do nothing except, say, maybe watch TV or read something else that does not tickle your brain.
Fred Kumerow, Professor Emeritus of the University of Illinois, speaking with me in May of 2014, and it seems as though his secrets for longevity worked for him. Kumerow was 102 when he died on May 31st. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.